Let the words of my mouth and the meditation of my heart be always acceptable in thy sight, O Lord, my strength and my redeemer. Amen. I've been warned because of some of my oral proclivities. I've been commanded to keep my words brief under pain of excommunication. So I'll try to do that. Times have been incredibly trying and busy in my life, both as just as a person, as an activist, especially since October 16th of 2006, when the Military Commissions Act was made into law, which for the first time in American history actually legalized the torture of human beings. And Senator McCain put up a bit of a fuss, which I think lasted about 17 and a half seconds, and then caved. And I'm pretty sure that what happened is that there was a backdoor conversation where the Republican Party asked him to let this one slide and solve it when he's president. And I think that's a bit of a metaphor for the way in which we tend to go about solving the world's problems. We tend to think that we are the answer. And as long as we can have that access route into a position of power or have the ear of the Pope or something of that sort, that's how we're going to make change. And we make sure that we are not the ones thwarted in the process. And in the end, the process thwarts us. And I was having a conversation earlier with some students from Notre Dame, and we were talking about how can we change American foreign policy, or how can we be a better instrument of peace. And I've had a lot of conversations like this, and the more that I do this work, the more that on the one hand I'm gratified to feel like I'm a part of a mission that's positive, but also the more exhausted and lonely I become in the process, because the travelers are few, and we need each other in a very real sense. And I've come to a few preliminary conclusions that I think that maybe the two most radical and radically political things a person can do in life is to have a family, or to perhaps join an order, become a priest, a sister, a brother, join a Catholic worker community. It's not with the NGOs, it's not with running for office, of anything of that sort, but forming communities of solidarity, which is the exhortation that John Paul II made in his battles with communism and the work of the solidarity movement in Poland. Now, I come from a military family. My grandfather fought in World War II, Korea, and Vietnam. My dad was an Army captain. My aunt was in the Army as well. And looking back, it's kind of hard to comprehend the degree to which my faith and my nationalism were exactly the same thing. Being a part of a community that was, in a sense, neo-Zionist about American exceptionalism and the fruits of American labor and the warrior mythology following World War II, that every single time soldiers put on uniforms and go to foreign lands, it's to save the world in the way that I was told by my grandparents about American involvement in World War II. And remembering that I once believed that, and remembering who I was when I wore a uniform, is an incredibly trying event. And the words of Jim Forrest this morning were monumentally chastening. The idea that we are servants of truth and not the other way around. And to be careful of using truth as a weapon and making sure that the only casualty in the battle is falsehood. It's incredibly chastening, especially after a conversation I had last Thursday night with the head of the ROTC program, the head of Army ROTC, Lieutenant Colonel Kelly Jordan. We had a very heated debate, and some of you may have read about it in the South Bend Tribune. And I had a conversation with my mother the day before I left for Rome to meet up with Tom Cornell and Mike Griffin to speak with the individuals in the Vatican that we were blessed to have access to. And I told my mom, I said, of course I can sit down and I can have civil discourse with just about anybody. I can make myself do that, but I have no comprehension what it's like to believe what I used to believe. I don't have those categories anymore. And I don't understand when people say that they want to sit down and have dialogue with the president. In a situation of domestic violence, your first instinct is not to lavish the abuser with charity and sympathy. You stop the violence, you stop the abuse. And part of the charity that you show the person is a penance. And I said, I can't understand sitting at the table and talking with President Bush. We don't talk to him, we incarcerate him. And for me, as a person who grew up in exactly the demographic that the president was targeting, those are hard words to eat, to comprehend historically, psychologically, that the good people that I was raised with, that taught me about Jesus, that's the ideology that I am so incensed about. But one of the things that I remember is the fact that my decision to become a conscientious objector and my eventual decision to become a Catholic was an 8-year journey. It started when I was 17, and when I made my decision to apply for conscientious objection, I was 24, and I wasn't accepted into the Catholic Church until last Easter. This is my first Lent as an actual Catholic. I entered the military first when I was 17 in the Army Reserves, and I had ambitions of attending West Point and perhaps going on into politics. And I didn't like politicians who didn't serve in the military. I thought there was something vastly hypocritical about a person who has the power to send people to war but had never been there themselves. And which is exactly the situation we find ourselves in right now, where the main protagonists of the Iraq War, whether it's political personalities or theological personalities, from George Bush to Paul Weigel, or George Weigel, not a day spent in service, in uniform, in combat at least. My experience of combat is what most chastened my conscience. And what I am most ardent about and desirous to comprehend more is how to bring back the concept of personhood back into politics, and how to bring back the concept of personhood in theological discourse. And that is exactly the hardest thing for me as a person to comprehend when I'm in a debate with Lieutenant Colonel Jordan and remembering that he's a person in the same way that I was a person when I was once on his side. And I'd like to say I have the answer to solving that dilemma. But now, being 27 years old, I haven't reached the wisdom of Gandalf yet in figuring that path out, which is why coming to things like these conferences and having the friends that I do at the Catholic Peace Fellowship is absolutely indispensable to me as a human being. I said that when we were in our small group discussions, I said that my vocation was, pardon the slightly crude nature of my answer, but it was to suck as little as possible. And I don't know how to get much more specific than that. I guess technically speaking, I've left the Army 3 times. I voluntarily left West Point shortly after about 5 months of my stay as a cadet there. And I went in, and it wasn't for any ethical reason. It was simply I felt stifled. I wanted to read Kant at 2 a.m. more than I wanted to shine boots and show up in formation. But the nationalism that I was raised in still had me very much on a track of becoming an officer. I just thought there would be a different path to getting there. And so I went into ROTC at the University of Iowa and encountered similar struggles. And I didn't necessarily have a language to map onto it for what I was feeling. Because like most of the people who are in military service, they either have not been very well catechized, they haven't been very well educated. In order to articulate what's going on inside them and what's happening in the world. And I had some significant people in my life who tried to convince me that my talents and abilities were elsewhere and that there were many ways to serve a country. And I wasn't quite convinced, because that's not the mythology that I was raised in. And I served a bit of time on reserve status, and I was called back up to full active duty after 9/11. And by that time, my politics had shifted a little bit. I'd read a few more books, and I'd become a little bit skeptical, politically speaking, about what was happening in the war, but I didn't feel like I had an ethical alternative. I knew that something had to be done after 9/11, because 3,500 people died in an instant. But I didn't know if I wasn't to fulfill my oath, to fulfill my duty, I didn't know what else I was going to do. I didn't want to simply be another upper middle class white kid who drinks lattes and studies at the university while his friends that he signed up in the military with are sent over to Afghanistan. I didn't want to be that kind of guy. And so I went back into the military, but I was very anxious about what was going to happen. And I was trained as an interrogator and as an Arabic linguist, and I chose that job because it was the only job that guaranteed language training, and I had an interest in learning foreign language. Very simple reasons. Nothing profound, necessarily, like most of the people who enter the military. Providing a skill that they want, providing access to education, perhaps. But it turned out to be a very providential path for me, for where I was placed eventually. I was the very first person, or I was the only person in the crowd to raise his hand when the convoy commander said, "Who's never done this before?" I was at the Baghdad International Airport, and we were about to take an armored convoy ride to Abu Ghraib, where I would be stationed as an interrogator in the wake of the prisoner abuse scandal. I was a part of the 202nd Military Intelligence Battalion, and we were the people sent to the prison to clean the place up. And the convoy commander came through the crowd, and he looked me in the eye, and he said, "We don't fire warning shots. If you ever move your selector lever from safe to semi, you shoot to kill." And then I had the most vigilant 20-minute ride of my life. And thoughts of liberty and democracy were nowhere to be found. I was thinking, who's on the top of the roof? What's that on the side of the road? And my mind turned to instinct and to training, which basically meant my mind was blank. And it took a good month for that blankness to be imprinted by things that I had remembered from before I went to Iraq. The readings I had done and was continuing to do of John Paul II, of St. Francis, of St. Athanasius, in my budding explorations of ancient Christianity. And it took about that same amount of time, about a month, to not only get out of the cycle, at least initially, get out of the cycle of instinct and mindless action, that I also started figuring out how things work in combat, because usually soldiers have about a month of naivety where they think that everything's going to work in the way that they were trained and that all of their knowledge is going to be very fruitful. And then you realize start figuring out how the real world works in combat. And when I got to the prison, there were about 12,000 detainees, and it took about a month to realize that the people I was interrogating were 14-year-old boys, local laborers, young fathers, school teachers, veterans of previous Iraqi wars. I had over 130 combat interrogations, and I can count on one hand the number of people I spoke to that were guilty of anything worse than being Arab. Then came the reports about torture that I wrote. Bruised bodies when they came into the prison, pictures of what had happened to people in the first 72 hours of detention. And eventually came the stories of my friends who were on those units, who were doing the torturing. Several of my friends were a part of interrogation units that use techniques of induced hypothermia, where you strip a man naked during winter, pour ice-cold water over his body, shove him in front of an air conditioning unit, and you drop his body temperature until it hovers around 86 degrees. If it drops below 86 degrees Fahrenheit, that's when the organs start to fail. And that's the president's definition of torture, is organ failure. You repeatedly take his rectal temperature, partly to make sure that his body temperature doesn't drop too low. But often these kinds of procedures would be done very violently, which sodomizes the man. And on October 16th of 2006, all these became legal because the organs didn't fail, or that was the presupposition. And individuals like me, like my friends, were given a get-out-of-jail-free card so that we can't be charged with war crimes. And all of this is happening in the midst of news releases and news reports from Iraq that talk about the insurgency as if it's one thing. And one of the terrors of the war is not necessarily solely the violence that's being done to Iraq, although we never seem to remember that it's not just returning soldiers who have post-traumatic stress disorder, but there are 26 million Iraqis who have post-traumatic stress disorder. There's probably 5% of the violence in Iraq that could actually be attributed to terrorism, groups like Al-Qaeda and the rest. Maybe 30 to 40% is actual political insurgency, individual groups that have specific political agendas. And the vast majority of violence that happens in Iraq has to be attributed to what's called the tribal defense system, which is basically neighborhood watch with guns. That's certainly not the picture that comes over on the news. And I know I don't need to necessarily preach to the choir on these kinds of issues. But for me, when I came back from the war and I was hearing these kinds of things come over the news, I would just want to take off my shoe and just throw it at the television screen, because none of these things are abstract to me. As an interrogator, I never had an abstract view of the enemy. I saw him across my table. I knew the names and ages of his children, his wife. And when I talk about the exhausting and the lonely aspect of doing this kind of work, I was on the board of directors of Iraq Veterans Against the War, and we were doing some great work in my mind. But for those of us who've been there, this is all just radically personal. It's radically personal stuff.